existence of superior races, or of races naturally and inevitably and eternally inferior. For Du Bois, to deny this fact is to throw open the door of the world to a future of hatred, war, and murder, such as never yet has staggered a bowed and crucified humanity. At Birmingham, Harding obliquely spoke out against the Klan and its extra-legal vigilantism. The nation which withstood internecine conflict, so heroically fought as was the Civil War, will tolerate the threat of no minority which challenges the supremacy of law or endangers our common welfare, Harding said. There will never come the day when the rights of any minority are denied, and no minority shall ever challenge the supremacy of the rule of law. The president was more direct on the Klan question in the third week of May 1923, when he dedicated a statue of Alexander Hamilton at the Treasury Department. We have our factions which seek to promote this or that interest, without regard to the relationship to others, and without regard for the common weal, Harding said. We have the factions of hatred and prejudice and violence. Hamilton warned us that, however such combinations or associations may now and then answer popular ends, they are likely themselves to usurp the reins of government, destroying afterward the very engines which have lifted them to unjust dominion. The New York Times' headline on its story about the event made it clear that no one doubted what Harding was talking about. Harding deplores growth of factions and strikes at Klan. He made the same case to the Imperial Grand Council of the Ancient Order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine in June of that year. Of menacing organizations, Harding said, this isn't fraternity, this is conspiracy. In attempts to hurt Harding with racially minded white voters in the Jim Crow era, his political opponents had long trafficked in rumors that he had black ancestry. In the 1920 presidential campaign, a professor at the College of Worcester in Ohio, William E. Chancellor, produced inflammatory pamphlets on the subject. By means of a fake family tree and a number of worthless affidavits, the historian Robert K. Murray wrote, Chancellor's circulars showed that no fewer than four separate and converging lines of Harding ancestors possessed Negro blood. Harding chose to meet the allegations with a dignified public silence, as did his wife, Florence. I want you to know I have known about these miserable attacks, Mrs. Harding wrote a friend. But more than that, I want you to be assured and absolutely certain that I am not in the least disturbed by them. We are unafraid, undismayed, and undisturbed. In private, Harding acknowledged that the facts of the matter were a mystery to him. How do I know, Jim? Harding privately said to James Faulkner of the Cincinnati Inquirer. One of my ancestors may have jumped the fence. In 2015, DNA testing disproved the speculation. There were other rumors, too. After Harding's death in 1923, the Klan put out the word that Harding had, as president, secretly joined its ranks while in office. We have 227 in the House of Representatives and 27 in the United States Senate, Basil E. Newton of the Klan's Imperial Council exaggeratedly claimed, and we held one initiation in the dining room of the White House. You know what that means. The Coolidge administration said the reports were too ridiculous to discuss. Coolidge, the new president, had been at his boyhood home in Vermont when the news about Harding's death came, and he took the oath of office in the middle of the night from his father, a notary public. Taciturn and enigmatic, an embodiment of New England rectitude, frugality, and learning, President Coolidge was a more interesting man than either many of his contemporaries or most historians have thought him. Though he, like Harding, refrained from taking the Klan on by name. Coolidge offered the country some glimpses of its better self. In the general election campaign of 1924, Coolidge's running mate, Charles G. Dawes, denounced the Klan in a speech in Augusta, Maine. "Government cannot last if that way, the way of the Ku Klux Klan, is the way to enforce the law in this country," Dawes said that August. "Lawlessness cannot be met with lawlessness if civilization is to be maintained." Dawes tried to soften his attack, though, adding, as the New York Times put it, that "many join it in the interest of law and order." The speech, the Times reported, had confounded the party in Maine and left the audience unresponsive. After conferring with Coolidge, Dawes dropped the subject. It was apparently the president's judgment that the less said about the Klan, the better. He was probably fearful that a direct attack on the Klan by name would detract from addressing the pressing issues of post-war Reconstruction, then demanding the attention of the American people, as well as sow the seeds of discord among them at the very moment when national unity was essential for moving forward, the Coolidge scholar Jerry L. Wallace wrote. In addition, such an attack would provide the Klan with a gold mine of publicity and likely bring it renewed vigor, which, as Simmons had pointed out, had happened when Congress had investigated the Klan in 1921. Moreover, Wallace wrote, the president undoubtedly realized from his study of history that hate groups like the Klan had historically come and gone, and that this Klan would be no different. Thus, it was best to let the Klan burn itself out, which, indeed, it did. Still, Coolidge's reticence had a price. One political consequence was that black leaders, especially the younger ones, began to question their historic relationship with the Republican Party, Wallace wrote, and urban Democrat politicians like Al Smith moved to take advantage of this. On Saturday, August 9, 1924, Coolidge did make himself plain. A correspondent had written the president to express outrage at news that a black man was considering seeking the Republican nomination for a congressional seat from New York. "It is of some concern," the man had written, "whether a Negro is allowed to run for Congress anywhere, at any time, in any party, in this, a white man's country." Coolidge replied that he was amazed at the letter. Citing the service of 500,000 black men in the U.S. armed forces during the Great War, the president wrote, "The suggestion of denying any measure of their full political rights to such a great group of our population as the colored people is one which, however it might be received in some other quarters, could not possibly be permitted by one who feels a responsibility for living up to the traditions and maintaining the principles of the Republican Party. Our Constitution guarantees equal rights to all our citizens, without discrimination on account of race or color. I have taken my oath to support that Constitution. It is the source of your rights and my rights. I propose to regard it and administer it as the source of the rights of all the people, whatever their belief or race." The African-American Chicago Defender published Coolidge's letter under the headline, "Cal Coolidge Tells Kluxer When to Stop." Words like these set a proper tone, but the causes of the Klan's fall were complex. Americans did not wake up one morning and decide to be a better people. For one thing, restrictive immigration law in the 1920s, particularly the National Origins Act of 1924, which set limiting quotas, diffused the passion around the issue. There were fewer targets as the years went by. The 805,228 immigrants arriving in 1921, for instance, fell to 164,000 by the end of the decade. Economic growth, the much-heralded prosperity of the decade which put the roar in the Roaring Twenties, also reduced tensions. As more people came to have a stake in the nation's success, and as that success became ever more linked to a widening opportunity, fewer of them were vulnerable to the Klan's creed. Commerce was culture. Relative security in wages and employment undercut the potency of the politics of fear. The Klan sabotaged itself, too, as when one of its key leaders, David Curtis Stevenson of Indiana, was arrested for the kidnapping, rape, and murder of a young woman on whom he had gnawed in a gruesome crime. He was convicted of second-degree murder. "I'm a nobody from nowhere, really, but I've got the biggest brains," he had said during his rise to power. "I'm going to be the biggest man in the United States." As historians of the KKK phenomenon have noted, the revelation of depravity and of hypocrisy at the pinnacle of the Klan undercut the organization's self-righteous claims to be an irreproachable knighthood. For his part, Coolidge urged the country to move beyond the forces that had fueled the rise of the Second Klan. Addressing a convention of the American Legion in Omaha, Nebraska, on Tuesday, October 6, 1925, Coolidge was broad-gauged. Whether one traces his Americanism back three centuries to the Mayflower, or 3 years of the steerage, is not half so important as whether his Americanism of today is real and genuine, Coolidge said. "No matter by what various crafts we came here, we are all now in the same boat." He spoke of tolerance and of liberalism. "Granting first the essentials of loyalty to our country and to our fundamental institutions, we may not only overlook, but we may encourage differences of opinion as to other things," Coolidge said. "For differences of this kind will certainly be elements of strength rather than of weakness. They will give variety to our tastes and interests. They will broaden our vision, strengthen our understanding, encourage the true humanities, and enrich our whole mode and conception of life." In an indirect but unmistakable allusion to the Klan and its 100% Americanism platform, Coolidge told the veterans, "I recognize the full and complete necessity of 100% Americanism. But 100% Americanism may be made up of many various elements." Coolidge added, "If we are to have that union of spirit which is the foundation of real national genius and national progress, we must all realize that there are true Americans who did not happen to be born in our section of the country, who do not attend our place of religious worship, who are not of our racial stock, or who are not proficient in our language. If we are to create on this continent a free republic and an enlightened civilization that will be capable of reflecting the true greatness and glory of mankind, it will be necessary to regard these differences as accidental and unessential. We shall have to look beyond the outward manifestations of race and creed. Divine providence has not bestowed upon any race a monopoly of patriotism and character." Afterward, Henry Hugh Proctor, a graduate of Nashville's Fisk College and of the Yale Divinity School, a friend of W.E.B. Du Bois and pastor of the First Congregational Church in Atlanta, and later the Nazarene Congregational Church in Brooklyn, reflected on Coolidge's message. "Particularly do we want to thank you for that great word you spoke at Omaha. The bravest word spoken by any executive in 60 years, Proctor said. It sounds like Lincoln." Chapter 5. The Crisis of the Old Order. The Great Depression, Huey Long, the New Deal, and America First. "We must drive the Jewish international bankers out of Wall Street," We must destroy the Bolshevik labor unions. We must purge our country of all the alien elements and ideas that now infest her. America for Americans. The fictional former president Shagpoke Whipple in Nathaniel West's 1934 novel, A Cool Million. The only limit to our realization of tomorrow will be our doubts of today. Let us move forward with strong and active faith. Franklin D. Roosevelt, Undelivered Jefferson Day Address, April 1945. On Christmas Eve, 1929, not quite 2 months after the disastrous stock market crash, dessert was being served to President Herbert Hoover and his holiday guests in the state dining room when word came that the West Wing was in flames. The Oval Office itself, installed by President Taft during a 1909 renovation, was burning. According to published reports, the president, dressed in a dinner jacket and smoking a cigar, excused himself to inspect the fire. At times, it seemed as if the flames were subdued, the New York Times wrote, but there were occasional bursts of blaze through the roof, and the firemen had great difficulty in getting control of the situation. In the main part of the mansion, the First Lady tried to distract the guests by asking the Marine Band to play on. Metaphors don't come much more apropos. The Hoover White House, at the onset of the Great Depression, subject to the destructive whims of an uncontrollable force. Those parts which had not been actually destroyed, the Times noted of the West Wing, were gutted and water-soaked. Something seemingly invincible, impervious to destruction, was proving vulnerable. The same would soon be said of America itself. By 1932-33, the Great Depression was consuming the United States, creating public anxiety and eroding trust in the most basic of institutions. In his trilogy on Roosevelt and the New Deal, published between 1957 and 1960, the historian Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., referred to the 1920s and early 30s as the crisis of the old order. America seemed on the cusp of a violent break from the ancien régime of democratic capitalism. Would the nation save itself, or, like Italy and, as the 30s unfolded, Germany, seek comfort in totalitarianism? Or might it choose the path of the Soviet Union, casting its lot with communism? The questions were not academic. When the financier Bernard M. Baruch said the nation was facing a situation worse than war, there was, Time reported, widespread agreement. Nearly 20% of the workforce, or 1 out of 5 people, was jobless. The country had never before known unemployment of these magnitudes or of this duration, the historian David M. Kennedy wrote. It had in place no mechanism with which to combat mass destitution on this scale. Mobs of hungry youths were loose in the countryside. Armed standoffs roiled placid places such as Sioux City, Iowa. A Senate committee was told hard truths. There are many signs that if the lawfully constituted leadership does not soon substitute action for words, a new leadership, perhaps unlawfully constituted, will arise and act. Hoover's successor knew all this. In the summer of 1932, Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt of New York had told an advisor that the two most dangerous men in America were Huey Long of Louisiana and Douglas MacArthur, the Army Chief of Staff. Long, the powerful Louisiana kingfish, could conceivably orchestrate a coup from the populist left, and MacArthur might manage the same feat from the right. The general had already led a disastrous U.S. Army attack on veterans gathered in Washington seeking a promised pension bonus. MacArthur has decided to go into active command in the field, said MacArthur, speaking, as was his wont, in the third person. There is incipient revolution in the air. The loudest cheers during Roosevelt's inaugural address on Saturday, March 4, 1933, did not come from his assurance that the only thing Americans had to fear was fear itself. No, as Eleanor Roosevelt noted, the greatest ovation greeted the new president's assertion that the present emergency might require him to assume extended wartime executive powers. It was a mad and maddening time. In the middle of February 1933, Roosevelt, then the president-elect, was nearly killed in a park in Miami when an armed assailant, Giuseppe Zangara, opened fire from about 10 yards away. FDR had stopped off in the city while on a fishing cruise aboard the Normahal, a yacht owned by his friend Vincent Astor. When Roosevelt disembarked, Astor, seeing the huge crowds, had a strange premonition. It would be easy, the millionaire remarked, for an assassin to do his work and escape. Within half an hour, armed with an $8 pearl-handled .32 revolver, Zangara got off 5 shots, but missed Roosevelt, instead wounding the mayor of Chicago, Anton Cermak, who was standing near the president-elect. The news was yet another blow to the country's fragile sense of stability. People seemed to feel that their faith in the future was also the assassin's target, Time wrote. Attending to the mayor, FDR, for his part, was preternaturally calm. "I'm all right," he called out. Roosevelt was simply himself, easy, confident, poised, to all appearances unmoved, Roosevelt advisor Raymond Mulley recalled. That night, safely back on the Normahal, Roosevelt drank a glass of whiskey and went to bed. The assassination attempt exacerbated a fraught season. Asked whether history had ever seen anything like the Depression, John Maynard Keynes replied, "Yes, it was called the Dark Ages, and it lasted 400 years. In 1930, testifying before Congress, Father Charles Coughlin, the popular, often incendiary radio priest, said, "I think by 1933, unless something is done, you will see a revolution in this country." Describing the plight of the unemployed, the historian William Manchester wrote, "Although millions were trapped in a great tragedy for which there could plainly be no individual responsibility, social workers repeatedly observed that the jobless were suffering from feelings of guilt. 'I haven't had a steady job in more than 2 years,' a man facing eviction told a New York Daily News reporter in February 1932. 'Sometimes I feel like a murderer. What's wrong with me that I can't protect my children?'" A small group of rich Wall Streeters also tried their hand at conceiving and launching a plot to supplant FDR as president by attempting to convince the retired Marine Major General Smedley Butler, a respected veteran, to raise an army, march on Washington, and take the Capitol. Fearful of Roosevelt and his reforms, the Wall Street putsch conspirators were planning to impose a fascist state. The episode was also known as the business plot. Butler was an unwilling traitor. "If you get 500,000 soldiers advocating anything smelling of fascism," Butler told one of the plotters who approached him, "I am going to get 500,000 more and lick the hell out of you, and we will have a real war right at home." The retired general told FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover about the conspiracy. Reports about the Wall Street cabal's machinations soon leaked, and the threat fell apart. In late 1934, secret congressional hearings, highlights of which were reported in the press, detailed what the plotters had been planning. Twice awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, Butler testified before a House panel led by Congressman John McCormick of Massachusetts and Samuel Dickstein of New York. "May I preface my remarks by saying, sir," Butler told McCormick, who co-chaired the committee, "that I have one interest in all of this, and that is to try to do my best to see that a democracy is maintained in this country." Nobody who has either read about or known about General Butler would have anything but that understanding, McCormick replied. The retired general then offered his side of the story of being approached by well-funded intermediaries to lead a military takeover of Roosevelt's Washington. "General Butler bears fascist plot to seize government by force," read the front page headline in the New York Times on Wednesday, November 21, 1934. If General Butler had not been the patriot he was, and if they had been able to maintain secrecy, the plot certainly might very well have succeeded, having in mind the conditions existing at that time, McCormick recalled to the author Jules Archer nearly four decades later. "No one can say for sure, of course, but when times are desperate and people are frustrated, anything like that could happen. If the plotters had got rid of Roosevelt, there's no telling what might have taken place. A well-organized minority can always outmaneuver an unorganized majority, as Adolf Hitler did. The same thing could have happened here." McCormick had little patience for skepticism about the gravity of the possible coup. The people were in a very confused state of mind, making the nation weak and ripe for some drastic kind of extremist reaction, McCormick said. Mass frustration could bring about anything. General Butler, McCormick added, regarded the plot very gravely indeed. He knew that this was a threat to our very way of government by a bunch of rich men who wanted fascism. Sinclair Lewis's 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here, told the story of the rise of an authoritarian state in an America riven by economic and cultural chaos. Lewis's book painted a disturbing portrait of a United States that abandoned liberal democracy and sought stability in fascism. "Why, there's no country in the world," a fictional editor remarks in the novel, "that can get more hysterical, yes, or more obsequious than America." The editor's sad rhetorical query, "Where in all history has there ever been a people so ripe for a dictatorship as ours?" Across the Atlantic, Winston Churchill took note of Lewis's book. "I was reading the other day a recent American novel by Sinclair Lewis, It Can't Happen Here," Churchill wrote in August 1936. "Such books render a public service to the English-speaking world. When we see what has happened in Germany, Italy, and Russia, we cannot neglect their warning." Less well-known than Lewis's work is a small novel by Nathaniel West, A Cool Million, a Candide Horatio Alger parody. Published a year before It Can't Happen Here, A Cool Million includes the tale of the rise of a fascist politician. In it, a former American president, Shagpoke Whipple, takes advantage of the Depression to demagogue his way back to power. Here is West's portrait of a Whipple rally. "I'm a simple man," he said with great simplicity, "and I want to talk to you about simple things. You'll get no highfalutin' talk from me. First of all, you people want jobs, isn't that so? Well, that's the only and prime purpose of the National Revolutionary Party, to get jobs for everyone. This is our country, and we must fight to keep it so. If America is ever again to be great, it can only be through the triumph of the revolutionary middle class. We must drive the Jewish international bankers out of Wall Street. We must destroy the Bolshevik labor unions. We must purge our country of all the alien elements and ideas that now infest her. America for Americans. Back to the principles of Andy Jackson and Abe Lincoln." West was writing fiction, but only just. Perhaps the most consequential figure of the day, aside from FDR himself, was Huey Long, the former Louisiana governor who went to the U.S. Senate in 1932. Charismatic, wily, ambitious, and able, Long had a deep connection to poor voters who felt marginalized and to middle-class people who felt threatened. At lunch one day at Hyde Park, the Roosevelt family seat, the flamboyant Long arrived in a loud suit and a colorful tie. "Who is that awful man sitting to my son's right?" Sarah Delano Roosevelt asked. Long was strikingly effective on the campaign trail. After watching him charm the farmers of the West and the Plains, five Democratic state chairmen sent word back to headquarters. "If you have any doubtful state," they wrote Party Chief James Farley, "send Huey Long to it." When Roosevelt lost the vote in Pennsylvania to Hoover in November 1932, Farley realized his mistake in failing to deploy Long to the depressed mining regions. "We never again underrated him," Farley recalled. Change, revolutionary change, was at hand, Long believed, and he saw himself as the tribune of the people. "A mob is coming here in 6 months to hang the other 95 of you damned scoundrels," Long told a fellow senator, "and I'm undecided whether to stick here with you or go out and lead them." Before a meeting with the president-elect himself, Long told reporters ominously, "I'm going to ask him, did you mean it or didn't you mean it?" By "it," Long meant his own vision of the redistribution of wealth, which he believed key to saving capitalism itself. "Certainly we are facing communism in America," Long said. "The country has been going toward communism ever since the wealth of this country began to get into the hands of a few people." In an April 1932 speech to the Senate called "The Doom of America's Dream," Long argued that both Democrats and Republicans had failed the country at one time or another. Power was concentrated in the hands of a self-serving financial and political elite. Only radical change, brought about by dynamic, unconventional leaders, leaders like Long, could make the nation the property of the people once more. The great and grand dream of America, that all men are created free and equal, endowed with the inalienable right of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. This great dream of America, this great light and this great hope, has almost gone out of sight in this day and time, and everybody knows it. And there is a mere candle flicker here and yonder to take the place of what the great dream of America was supposed to be. Unless we provide for the redistribution of wealth in this country, the country is doomed. There is going to be no country left here very long. That may sound a little bit extravagant, but I tell you that we are not going to have this good little America here long if we do not take to redistribute the wealth of this country. He focused not only on the poor. "Where is the middle class today?" Long asked in 1933. "Where is the corner groceryman about whom President Roosevelt speaks? He is gone or going. Where is the corner druggist? He is gone or going. Where is the banker of moderate means? He is vanishing. The middle class today cannot pay the debts they owe and come out alive. In other words, the middle class is no more." Long was a master at generating headlines. He delighted in starting a fight, his biographer T. Harry Williams wrote. "Things are awfully quiet around here," Long would say to his secretary, Earl Christenberry. "What have you got in your files that we can liven them up with?" A Democratic colleague said, "Frankly, we are afraid of him. He is unscrupulous beyond belief. He might say anything about me, something entirely untrue, but it would ruin me in my state. It's like challenging a buzzsaw. He will go to the limit. It is safer for me and the rest of us to leave him alone." One day in the Senate, much to the delight of the spectators in the galleries, Long was baiting Tennessee Senator Kenneth McKellar. The presiding officer tried to calm the crowd when Senator Alvin Barkley of Kentucky spoke up. "When the people go to a circus," Barkley said, alluding to Long, "they ought to be allowed to laugh at the monkey." Writing in The Nation in 1935, the journalist and broadcaster Raymond Graham Swing took Long's measure as candidate for the presidency. "He will be direct, picturesque, and amusing, a relief after the attenuated vagueness of most of the national speaking today," Swing wrote. "As long as Americans trusted FDR and believed in the New Deal," Swing wrote, "all would be well. But if that faith were to collapse, Long might well be the man of that troubled hour." "Huey's chances depend on those sands of hope and trust running out," Swing wrote. "He is no menace if the president produces reform and recovery. But if, in 2 years, even six, misery and fear are not abated in America, the field is free to the same kind of promise-mongers who swept away Democratic leaders in Italy and Germany." As his "Share Our Wealth" message spread, taking political form in grassroots clubs, Long grew in popularity. A banker from Montana wrote to Roosevelt saying that Long was "the man we thought you were when we voted for you." Lewis Howe, FDR's political advisor, told the president that, "It is symptoms like this I think we should watch very carefully." There was much to keep an eye on. Lawrence Dennis, a native of Georgia and a former Foreign Service officer, wrote a pair of books in the 30s, "Is Capitalism Doomed?" and "The Coming American Fascism." "I am in favor of a middle-class revolution," Dennis wrote, arguing that the media of the age made Americans susceptible to suggestion. "We have perfected techniques in propaganda and press and radio control, which should make the United States the easiest country in the world to indoctrinate with any set of ideas, and to control for any physically possible ends. Diversity, political, racial, religious, ethnic, was the enemy. Talk of equality for women or for racial and ethnic minorities would give the fascist movement room to run." To Dennis, "Undoubtedly the easiest way to unite and animate large numbers in political association for action is to exploit the dynamic forces of hatred and fear." While Long politicked and Dennis wrote, Charles Coughlin, a Roman Catholic priest who built a broadcasting kingdom on earth from the Royal Oak suburb of Detroit, was an influential voice over the airwaves. Coughlin started out as anti-communist in the late 1920s. His populist message would morph through the years, settling mainly on a platform of anti-Semitism. In broadcasts, when Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, came up, Coughlin would say, as if in passing, "whose original name was Alexander Levine." To Lawrence Dennis, the Coughlin-Long flocks were the perfect vehicles for revolution. "I hail these movements and pressure groups," Dennis wrote in 1935, "not because their members are as yet fascists or friends of fascism, but because they are making fascism the alternative to chaos and national disintegration." Hugh S. Johnson, a retired general and former head of Roosevelt's National Recovery Administration, lashed out at the president's foes in March 1935. "You can laugh at Father Coughlin, you can snort at Huey Long, but this country was never under a greater menace," Johnson said. "President Roosevelt," Johnson told the nation, "was our sole hope." That hope, the man chosen to rescue the nation from the abyss, Franklin Roosevelt, was hardly seen in a heroic light in the shadows of 1932. According to The New Republic, the New York governor was not a man of great intellectual force or supreme moral stamina. Walter Lippmann, the most important columnist of the time, wrote, "Franklin D. Roosevelt is no crusader. He is no tribune of the people. He is no enemy of entrenched privilege. He is a pleasant man who, without any important qualifications for the office, would very much like to be president." Oswald Garrison Villard, the NAACP co-founder, was harsh about the gentleman from Hyde Park. "He has spoken of the forgotten man," Villard wrote of Roosevelt, "but nowhere is there a real, passionate, ringing exposition of just what it is that the forgotten man has been deprived of, or what should be done for him. We can see in him no leader, and no evidence anywhere that he can rise to the needs of this extraordinary hour." Charming, cagey, and courageous, FDR would spend the next dozen or so years winning 4 White House terms and trying, with varying degrees of success, to prove his critics wrong. Americans in his time were questioning the very viability of the constitutional order and of capitalism itself. In his speech accepting the presidential nomination at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in July 1932, he addressed himself to the future. "Wild radicalism has made few converts, and the greatest tribute that I can pay to my countrymen is that in these days of crushing want, there persists an orderly and hopeful spirit on the part of the millions of our people who have suffered so much," Roosevelt said. "To fail to offer them a new chance is not only to betray their hopes, but to misunderstand their patience." The forces of progress, Roosevelt believed, were not to cower or to lash out, but to engage. To meet by reaction that danger of radicalism is to invite disaster, he said. "Reaction is no barrier to the radical. It is a challenge, a provocation. The way to meet that danger is to offer a workable program of reconstruction, and the party to offer it is the party with clean hands." He then introduced a crucial phrase. "I pledge you, I pledge myself," FDR said, "to a new deal for the American people." The crisis was existential. His impulse, Winston Churchill wrote of FDR in the mid-1930s, is one which makes toward the fuller life of the masses of the people in every land, and which, as it glows the brighter, may well eclipse both the lurid flames of German-Nordic self-assertion and the baleful, unnatural lights which are diffused from Soviet Russia. Roosevelt was, it is true, an unlikely revolutionary. Born into enveloping privilege at Springwood, his family's house at Hyde Park in New York's Hudson Valley, Roosevelt was educated at home, at Endicott Peabody's Groton School, at Harvard, and at Columbia Law School. His mother adored him with an all-consuming, even suffocating love. "Mama left this morning," he wrote his father at age 8 and a half, "and I am to have my bath alone." Theodore Roosevelt was his hero and role model. He married T.R.'s favorite niece, Eleanor, served in the New York State Senate, and went to Washington as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, a post T.R. had also held, under Wilson. His marriage survived the discovery of a love affair with Lucy Mercer, his wife's social secretary, in 1918, and he was nominated for vice president on the Democratic ticket with James M. Cox of Ohio in 1920. It was, by any measure, a dazzling life. And then, in August 1921, at his family's summer retreat at Campobello Island on the Bay of Fundy, Franklin Roosevelt was stricken with infantile paralysis. He would never walk unaided again. He was 39 years old. A quarter of a century later, after Roosevelt died at Warm Springs, Georgia, in the spring of 1945, Churchill, his wartime ally, rose in the House of Commons to pay tribute to the fallen American chief. an astute biographer, and a discerning statesman. Churchill, who said that FDR's death had struck him with the force of a physical blow, spoke about the great, if largely unmentioned, fact about the American president. President Roosevelt's physical affliction, Churchill said, lay heavily upon him. A man of courage, Churchill appreciated it when he detected courage in others, and he had seen it, intimately, in Franklin Roosevelt. It was a marvel that he bore up against it through all the many years of tumult and storm, Churchill said of FDR's paralysis. Not one man in 10 millions, stricken and crippled as he was, would have attempted to plunge into a life of physical and mental exertion and of hard, ceaseless political controversy. Not one in 10 millions would have tried. Not one in a generation would have succeeded, not only in entering this sphere, not only in acting vehemently in it, but in becoming indisputable master of the scene. Lyndon Johnson wept when he heard the news from Warm Springs. "He was just like a daddy to me, always," Johnson, then a congressman from Texas, said. "He was the one person I ever knew, anywhere, who was never afraid. God, God, how he could take it for us all." The New York Times wrote, "Men will thank God on their knees 100 years from now that Franklin D. Roosevelt was in the White House, in a position to give leadership to the thought of the American people and direction to the activities of their government in that dark hour when a powerful and ruthless barbarism threatened to overrun the civilization of the Western world." How did he do it? How did the man scorned in the beginning die a hero, bringing innumerable ordinary citizens to tears in the streets and on the farms of the country he loved? How did he salvage what seemed unsalvageable, rising to lead a nation through depression and world war? One answer, and there are more than a few, such as the complexity of history, lies in FDR's sense of hope, a spirit of optimism forged in his own experience. For it is not too much to say that a man who had personally survived cataclysm and overcome paralysis was well equipped, perhaps uniquely so, to prevail over national cataclysm and political paralysis. "This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper," Roosevelt told the country at his first inauguration. "So, first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. In every dark hour of our national life, a leadership of frankness and vigor has met with that understanding and support of the people themselves which is essential to victory. I am convinced that you will again give that support to leadership in these critical days." By one account, FDR had drawn on his own reading for the most historically memorable line of the address, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Eleanor told Roosevelt advisor Samuel Rosenman that a friend of hers had given the president-elect a volume of the writings of Henry David Thoreau not long before the inauguration. "Nothing is so much to be feared as fear," Thoreau had written in his journal entry for September 7, 1851. FDR had the book with him during his pre-inaugural stay in Suite 776 of the Mayflower Hotel. Roosevelt frequently picked up a book at his bedside for brief reading before turning out the lights, Rosenman recalled. It may be that in this way he came across the phrase, it stuck in his mind, and found its way into the speech. To Roosevelt, faith, powerful, resilient faith, was key. "We do not distrust the future of essential democracy," Roosevelt said in closing his first inaugural. "The people of the United States have not failed. In their need, they have registered a mandate that they want direct, vigorous action. They have asked for discipline and direction under leadership. They have made me the present instrument of their wishes. In the spirit of the gift, I take it. In that spirit, he carried on. Privately, he wondered if all would come out right. A friend told him he might well be remembered as the greatest of presidents if he succeeded, but that he would go down as the worst if he failed. "If I fail," Roosevelt replied, "I shall be the last one." Publicly, though, he never wavered. Conservatives hated him. Radicals thought him a milquetoast opportunist. Liberals weren't sure, from moment to moment, quite what to make of him. Just as he had to balance himself with steel braces on his legs, a cane in one hand and an aide, often one of his sons, on his other side, simply to force himself forward when he rose from his wheelchair. He called it stumping. Roosevelt maneuvered with care through the storms of the decade. It was part of his conception of his role, Advisor Rexford Tugwell said, that he should never show exhaustion, boredom, or irritation, or extremism of any kind. He had told Americans what to expect from him. Running for president in 1932, Roosevelt said, "Say that civilization is a tree which, as it grows, continually produces rot and dead wood. The radical says, cut it down. The conservative says, don't touch it. The liberal compromises. Let's prune so that we lose neither the old trunk nor the new branches." This campaign is waged to teach the country to march upon its appointed course, the way of change in an orderly march, avoiding alike the revolution of radicalism and the revolution of conservatism. As one might expect, this course failed to please the loudest voices in the sundry camps of American politics. "Franklin, darling, why is everyone opposed to so much of your program?" his mother once asked him. "A number of people have told me that they don't think it will work." "Mummy, I think I know who you have been talking with, and if I'm right, they are people who don't understand the first thing about government, never having served in it, nor have they the slightest conception of the great problems facing the nation," FDR replied. "Their only worry is that they might find themselves having to get along with two automobiles instead of three. But they don't give a hoot for the man who not only can't afford a car, but is unable to feed and clothe his family. These are the people I'm concerned about, and if I succeed in raising their standard of living, I won't lose any sleep over some of our friends who are opposed to my administration." Disappointed liberals lobbied the president to move more quickly on social and economic issues. "You'll never be a good politician," FDR once told Eleanor, who frequently presented such pleas to her husband. "You are too impatient." At a White House meeting, Roosevelt parried a questioner with a lesson in practical politics. "Lincoln," Roosevelt said, "was a sad man because he couldn't get it all at once, and nobody can. Maybe you would make a much better president than I have. Maybe you will someday. If you ever sit here, you will learn that you cannot, just by shouting from the housetops, get what you want all the time." He sometimes turned to sports to make his point. "I have no expectation of making a hit every time I come to bat," Roosevelt remarked. "What I seek is the highest possible batting average." He argued that leadership, even his own, was imperfect. A wise public, Roosevelt believed, would give a well-meaning, forward-leaning president the benefit of the doubt. "The country needs, and unless I mistake its temper, the country demands, bold, persistent experimentation," Roosevelt said in 1932. "It is common sense to take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another. But above all, try something. We need enthusiasm, imagination, and the ability to face facts, even unpleasant ones, bravely. His headmaster from Groton, Endicott Peabody, grasped the essence of his old pupil. At the time Franklin Roosevelt became president, Peabody said, things were in the worst kind of doldrums, owing to the inefficiency of Mr. Hoover as president. Change of a drastic nature was called for, and Franklin answered the call. Some of his policies have been mistaken. He prophesied that they would be. Many have, in my judgment, contributed to the benefit of the people at large and have saved this country from the serious attacks made upon it by extreme radicals. The rector, as Peabody was known, held a special place in Roosevelt's heart and mind. It is a great thing for our country, Peabody wrote Roosevelt, to have before it the leadership of a man who cares primarily for spiritual things. This was a common view among those who loved Roosevelt. You and I are for Roosevelt because he's a great spiritual figure, because he's an idealist, FDR confidant Harry Hopkins once remarked to the playwright and speechwriter Robert E. Sherwood. Oh, he sometimes tries to appear tough and cynical and flippant, but that's an act he likes to put on. For all the exigencies of political life, Roosevelt had been shaped by and drew sustenance from the message of hope that Peabody had taught him. Sustained by this view of progress, Roosevelt urged the nation onward. We shall strive for perfection, Roosevelt said. We shall not achieve it immediately, but we still shall strive. We may make mistakes, but they must never be mistakes which result from faintness of heart or abandonment of moral principle. Our Constitution of 1787 was not a perfect instrument. It is not perfect yet. But it provided a firm base upon which all manner of men, of all races and colors and creeds, could build our solid structure of democracy. The salience of hope, the dangers of fear, and the need for open American hearts were familiar Roosevelt themes throughout his presidency. When FDR died, Harry Hopkins called Robert Sherwood. You and I have got something great that we can take with us all the rest of our lives, Hopkins said, continuing, it's a great realization, because we know it's true what so many people believed about him and what made them love him. The president never let them down. That's what you and I can remember. Oh, we all know he could be exasperating, and he could seem to be temporizing and delaying, and he'd get us all worked up when we thought he was making too many concessions to expediency. But all of that was in the little things, the unimportant things, and he knew exactly how little and how unimportant they really were. But in the big things, all of the things that were of real, permanent importance, he never let the people down. Reporting from North Carolina in 1934, the journalist Martha Gellhorn wrote that she had found Roosevelt's portrait in house after house after house. The president, she wrote, was, at once, God and their intimate friend. He knows them all by name, knows their little town and mill, their little lives and problems. He is there and will not let them down. The novelist Sherwood Anderson affirmed the point. More than any man who has been president within the memory of any of us now living, Anderson wrote, he has made us feel close to him. Through the vagaries of the 30s, Roosevelt tacked this way and that, sometimes underreaching with the New Deal, sometimes overreaching. The New Deal is simply the effort of a lot of half-baked socialists to save capitalism for the dumb capitalists, a shrewd liberal remarked to the journalist John Gunther. Roosevelt's initial 2 years in office were focused